It is indeed in devotion to that Savior and His cause as to why we should count it a privilege to have a share in the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ, a share in supporting men not only who teach the gospel to the lost, but who are striving to build up those who have been redeemed by His blood. In fact, that's the way the Bible presents the message of giving. When we look at what the Bible teaches about giving, we see that it is indeed an act of worship. In a previous lesson, we spent some time looking at these passages that you have on the slide. And all we've done here in our study this morning is to take some key phrases out of those verses that emphasize the very point that we're talking about. And you can see that in each one of these verses, there's an emphasis upon one's attitude toward and devotion to God. In Genesis chapter 14, when Abraham tithed to Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High God, over and over again in those verses, Moses emphasized that what was being focused on is the fact that Melchizedek was a priest of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. That's the attitude that framed his desire to give a tenth of the spoils of war. In Genesis 28, verse 20 through 22, when Jacob pledged himself to give a tenth of what God would give him. You'll note this was in connection with the promise that was reiterated back up in the 15th verse, the threefold promise about the nation and the land and the messianic promise. And then he said, "The Lord will be my God." And so again, it's connected with this sense of devotion to God. In Exodus chapter 25 and Exodus chapter 35, there are two sections here about the building of the tabernacle. And over again in that particular contribution, where it says the people gave with a willing heart. In fact, it tells us later they gave so much that they had to tell the people to quit giving. One of the focuses in those chapters is that it's the Lord's contribution. And it was designed to build a place where God would dwell among the people and have fellowship with the people. You can read that text and see that. In Numbers chapter 18, where instructions are given for the support of the priest, while the people were giving them, and they were indeed to support the priest. Note in the text that they're called my offerings. They are actually given to the Lord. And then the Lord said he would give them to the priest for their support. That's not my language, that's the terminology of the text. Once again, focusing on the idea that giving was an act of one's declaration of the worthiness of God and his cause. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, in David's preparation for the temple, where there was such a willing attitude, you'll see that the reason was, he said, the temple was not for man, but for the Lord. And that's where the emphasis was in David's heart. And in that particular chapter, you see the people praising God and worshiping in connection with that preparation for the building of the temple. Then in the book of Malachi, chapter 3, when the prophet Malachi reproved the people for their failure to give as they should, their failure to tithe, the way he framed it was they were robbing God. And in the first chapter indicated that it grew out of their lack of respect for Jehovah. In 2 Corinthians 8, when you read about these people, the Macedonians, who though they were poor, wanted to have a share in helping fellow Christians, what lied behind that was, the apostle said, they first gave themselves to the Lord. And then in Philippians chapter 4, when the Philippians, again, they're in Macedonia, but they now had opportunity or ability. They had opportunity, but they didn't have the ability. They now have the ability to be able to support Paul. And so they did, and he said it's like a sacrifice well-pleasing to God. It was designed for Paul and his work at preaching the gospel, but it's called a sacrifice well-pleasing to God. This ought to cause us to look at our worship in this framework, our giving in this framework, as a reflection of our attitude of worship. Now, that having been said, how much should I give? People say, well, okay, I know I ought to give, and it ought to be a reflection of worship. How much should I give? Let me say at the very beginning that if one is not approaching giving out of an act of worship, it doesn't make any difference how much you're giving. You can be giving 50%. As far as you're personally concerned, it's not benefiting you. If it's not an expression of your devotion to God and your love for God and your love for if it's work, if it's merely a matter of rote, you just do this on the first day of the week, whether it's 5% or 15% or whatever it is, it's not going to benefit us personally. Secondly, if a person is not giving out of worship to God, everything else that I'm going to say in this lesson will probably have no effect. And so it begins with this concept that giving is an act of worship. And we're going to be addressing our study this morning to those who are sincerely interested in the question, I want to worship God. Now, what would be a reasonable amount to express my dedication to Him and to His cause? Should I give 100% of what I make? And you say, obviously, that's not the case. Is it 50%? Is it 30%? What? How much do I give? What, are there any guidelines for this matter of giving? Well, we're going to begin our study by looking at the concept of tithing. I've got four men that's going to hand out some sheets. If you four men would pass those out to the audience. When you get this sheet, you'll see it's a chart. And you'll see that on this chart, once you get it, that there are some figures at the top and along the side of this chart. And I'll explain what these represent. We're talking here about tithing. What is tithing? And we all know, I think, that it means you give a tenth. But to appreciate really what it involves, we've actually got some facts and figures here to help us appreciate what tithing would actually mean in practice. So let me give you a minute to get those sheets and be able to look at them for just a moment, and then we'll look at it together. Please look at the bottom of the chart, right at the bottom. You see on the bottom of the chart, we have annual gross income, and I've abbreviated that by AGI, annual gross income. And then there's another line that says income per week. I've abbreviated that with IPW. So that explains those four lines right at the bottom of your chart. For example, if your annual gross income is $15,000, your income per week would be $288. If your annual income, move over a couple columns, is $25,000 a year, your weekly income would be $481. And so it is with those two rows there at the bottom of the sheet. And what that allows you to do, you know what, if you know what your annual gross income is not after taxes, after pension, after you pay for your boat and your car, and after you eat out, gross income, the total of all that you make. Your annual gross income. Then you can see about how much your weekly income is. Now that's what's necessary to understand the chart. Now you go back up to the chart and you see I've got at the top income per week. And we're talking about tithing. So let's take the second column over, 300. If your annual income is 15,000, people may be working part-time or maybe they're retired or whatever the case may be, maybe they have other kind of income besides from a job, maybe an annuity or something else. But if your income is $15,000 a year, you approximately make $300 a week, $288 a week. So how much do you give? If you're tithing, you get down to $15. You say, I only make $15,000, so I give $15 a week. Well, you're giving 5%. You see a 15 on the left, you just go over to the 300 column, you're giving 5%. On the other hand, if you're giving $30 a week out of your income, you're only making $300. So how can I give 30? Well, that 30 would be 10%. If you were a Jew and you tithe, and that was your annual gross income, that's what you'd be giving. Move over to the fourth column. Let's say $500 a week. 500 means you're making about $25,000 a year. You see that at the bottom. The $25,000 annual gross income is about $481 a week. So I don't know what your income is, but you can figure it from there. So you're making $25,000, your income is $500, so plate comes by, you put in, say, $20. How much have you given? 4%. 4%. Go on down to the $50 column. If you put in $50, you're giving 10%. If you put in $60, 12%. That's how it figures out. All right, move on over to the $1,000 a week column, and you see down at the bottom of the sheet, that approximates $50,000 a year annual gross income. And we may be getting into a territory that's more practical in some ways with many people. But so we're looking at $50,000 a year gross. Remember, not after taxes, pension, retirement gross income. Okay? So here you have $1,000. So let's say the plate comes by, you put $20 in. So I'm giving to the Lord. I love the Lord and I love His cause. You're giving 2%. Let's say you put in $40. You're giving 40%. 50, 5%. Going down to $100, you put in $100. Now you're giving 10%. If you were a Jew, that's what the law was. We'll notice that in a minute. We went over to the $1,500 column, and you going down to $100 a week. So, well, I'm giving $100 a week. You're giving 6.7%. That's what you're giving. And then you move over to the $3,000 a column, and maybe not many people do that, but some people do and exceed that. That would be like an annual gross income of $150,000 a year. You see that at the bottom of your chart. So let's say a person now gives $100 a week. How much? 3%. 3.3% is what that amounts to. And there's people that do that, folks. There's men and women who make in excess of that, who put in $100 into the plate and think, boy, I am really giving. Are you? If you were a Jew, that's 3%. To give 10%, you're going down, you'll be putting in $300 a week. Okay, all I did that for, and we may have cause to reference that again, I want you to understand what we're talking about when we talk about tithing. It's easy to put a definition on the screen, say, oh, that means a tenth, but what does it mean in practicality? That's what it means. Now, tithing before the law of Moses. Now, in Genesis chapter 14 and verse 20, we looked at this passage before. Now, here, this is before the law that was given to Israel. But we run across this very interesting story where Melchizedek comes into the picture. He's a priest of the Most High God. Abraham has just accomplished a victory over these kings. And you see back up in verse 9, there were four kings. And so Abraham has taken his men and conquered those four kings. He meets this king coming back. And so he said in verse 20, "Blessed be the God Most High who delivered your enemies into your hand." And he gave him a tenth of all. I don't know what the spoils of war would be with four kings. How much would that be? How many animals? How many other things might be taken in conquering four kings? How much would you want to then turn around and give to this priest? He said he gave him a tenth of the spoils of the war with four kings. Where did he get the idea of a tenth? I do not know. Evidently, this is rooted in antiquity. I don't know at least where it began. It's not unique to the Jews, by the way. But that's what you see this man of faith doing. All right, now we get over to Genesis chapter 28, when Jacob goes to seek a wife, and he has this dream. And God, once again, in verse 14 and 15, promises to bless him. And so Jacob says this. He said, verse 20, "If God will be with me and keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God." You see again the idea of worship. The Lord will be my God. "This stone which I've set up as a pillar will be God's house. Listen now, of all that you give me, I shall give a tenth to you." Now, all he talked about in verse 20 was food and garments. But he said, "Of all that you give me, I'll give a tenth to you." Now, on his return, go over to Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30, verse 43. "The man became exceedingly prosperous and had large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys." You remember how God blessed him as he took care of Laban's flock, but Jacob then acquired a large herd. All right, now you go down to chapter 32. Now he's going to meet Esau on his way back, and he's concerned about Esau because you remember he had taken Esau's birthright and Esau's blessings. He's afraid Esau might be out to kill him and all that he had. So he's going to try to pacify Esau. So, in chapter 32, verse 5, he said, and Jacob, verse 3, says, "Sent messengers before him, and here's what you tell Esau." And here's what you tell him, verse 5, "I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants." When he left, it was Jacob. He's coming back. He's got servants. He's got animals. And not just one kind of animal. Not just one to do something. Oxen, donkeys, and flocks. You tell Esau that. And so you look further in the text here in Genesis chapter 32 and verse 13. He says he spent the night there. He selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, and 20 lambs, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. That was just one procession. And then there's another one. You see that in verse 16. And then there was another one, as you see that a little bit further, verse 19, the second and the third. How many animals did this man have that he could give that to Esau to try to pacify? How many had he gained during that period from the time he pledged to God, I'll give a tenth of all? Was it 1,000? Was it 10,000? I don't know. But you think about what he pledged. However many you give me, Lord, I'm going to give you a tenth of all. You know, you might think, well, you know, I'll give a real fine lamb. I'll give a real fine donkey or camel. A tenth of everything. And chapter 33, verse 14, let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I'll proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. You see, he still has a lot left on this journey, even though he gave all of this to Esau. And so here's a man who pledged to give a tenth, a tithe, and you take these figures on this sheet, instead of the figures here, make it animals. You know, 3,000 animals. How many do you give? Whatever it may be. Maybe just 3,000 camels or 3,000 donkeys. How many do you give? That's what the tithing was before the law. All right, now, tithing under the law of Moses. Now, over in the book of Numbers in chapter 18, look at Numbers chapter 18. This is a chapter about the support of the priest. Now, we don't have time to look at the whole chapter, but it's an interesting chapter. You go back and start reading back up in verse 8. Besides the tithes, they had a share of the offerings the people brought for various purposes. And various parts of those offerings, depending on the kind of offering, went for the priest and his family. All right, and then you come, and by the way, you take a burnt offering, everything was burnt up. Well, the priest got the hides. You think about over 600,000 soldiers, not counting the older men or the younger that couldn't go to war, bringing all these animals and sacrifice. You only have a tribe of 22,000 Levites. And among those, not all were old enough to serve. But you get the hides of all the burnt offerings that are offered. You divide 22,000 into 630,000, see what you get. How many hides would be given? Are they valuable? Are they useful? That's part of it. But we haven't even reached to the tithes. Not do we get down, you see in our text here to verse 24. And so in verse 24 he said, the tithe of the sons of Israel which they offer as an offering to the Lord. Now note it again. Who do they tithe to? You say to the priest. Well, that's true. But it's not all the story. No, they tithed it to the Lord. To the Lord. Now he said, I have given it to the Levite for an inheritance. And so, I tell you an interesting thing to do. You can go back in Numbers chapter 3 and you see the census where there were 603,550 soldiers. You get to the next chapter and you see there are 22,000 Levites. And again, not all of those were of age to serve. Let's suppose you have 603,550 men who make $10 a year. They give $1. That'd be $603,550. Divide that by 22,000 and figure up the income of the Levites by God's plan. He intended for these men to be well supported, we'll see a little bit later, so it would not impact their ability to give their attention and their time and their effort to the service they were supposed to do relative to the tabernacle and later the temple and preparing themselves to teach the people. But this is God's plan. They gave it to the Lord. When you get to verse 26, what about the Levites then? The other people in Israel were to tithe to the Levites. What about the Levites? He says to the Levites, you shall present an offering from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe. So the Levites got the tithe, and they tithe from that tithe to the priest. You have Levite, not all Levites are priests. All priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. So then the Levites would tithe to the priest. And then you come a little bit further in verse 28. You'll present an offering to the Lord from your tithes which you receive from the sons of Israel. And from it you shall give it the Lord's offering to Aaron the priest. Now you got the high priest, and then the priest tithes to him. So you see this tithing arrangement to support the priesthood that you find here in Numbers chapter 18. Now, how did that impact later the nation? We have here the support of the priest, Leviticus 18, 8 through 32. But look over in 2 Chronicles chapter 31. 2 Chronicles chapter 31 and verse 4. He commanded the people who lived in Jerusalem to give the portion due to the priests and Levites. Why? Why? That they might devote themselves to the law of the Lord. They're doing their duties and teaching the people. That was their job. They were the teaching tribe. That they may devote themselves to it. Turn over to Nehemiah chapter 13. Remember that Nehemiah came back to rebuild the walls, but he ran into all kinds of problems. One of the problems he found was the people were not providing for the support of the priesthood like they should. All right, look at Numbers chapter 13, verse 10. I discovered that the portion of the Levites had not been given them, so that the Levites and the singers who performed the service, what had they done? They started selling pizza, and they started selling insurance, and they started mowing yards, doing whatever they could to support their families. That's the way it might read today. No, what it says is, they went each to his own field. We got to do something to support our families. That wasn't God's plan. The other tribes took care of the field and the crops, the animals. You're mine. You're redeemed. You're my in place of the firstborn. You're my tribe. And so he said, I reprimanded the officials and said, why? Look, why are the Levites forsaken? Is that what your text says? What does your text say? Why is the house of God forsaken? You see, again, this focus on worship, attitude toward God. Why is the house of God forsaken? I gathered them together and restored them to their posts. All Judah then brought the tithe of grain, wine, oil into the storehouses, etc. So you see how it impacted when God's plan wasn't followed. It impacted God's plan for the nation as a whole. This was God's plan for the support of the priesthood. All right? Then, in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 30 through 33, I'm not going to take the time to read that. You can read it at your leisure. They tithe of their land, their produce, and of their animals. So if you're a farmer, let's say, and you raise, let's say, sheep or whatever it may be, however many sheep you had born that year, then at the end of the year you pass before this person, and he would every tenth one he would touch, and that one would go to the support of the priest. And then the tenth of the produce of the land. So they tithe of the land and the cattle. Now, besides the tithing, I've already mentioned their offerings for sin, praise, and thanksgiving, Leviticus 1 through 6. He talks about these offerings and what portion would be for the priest and his family. The first fruits of the land, when the crops came in, first fruits went for the priest. The firstborn, there was a redemption price paid for the firstborn. That went for the priest. What I'm telling you is this, folks, when we talk about a tithe, we say the Jews gave 10%. They gave a lot more than 10%. And that is, that was God's plan. Read it and see if there's anything wrong with what I'm saying. If you see something wrong with it, you tell me. But that's what I find, is that they gave a lot more than 10%. Now, somebody said, yeah, but they weren't taxed. Oh, yes, they were. God warned them about that through the prophet Samuel when they wanted a king. In 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 15 following, we will not read the rest of that chapter, but you'll note it says in verse 15, he will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and to his servants, etc. Yes, you're going to be taxed. And you have a king to support his rule, his dominion, his kingdom. Does that mean they didn't have to give a tenth anymore? Find it. So they're going to pay the tenth to the king, the tax, but they're still going to tithe. Over in the book of Malachi, in chapter 3, Now they're under Persian rule. I went and did some research on this very thing, and it's supported in the book of Esther. That was a time of Persian rule very close to this period. And the people were taxed by the Persian kings. In spite of the fact they were taxed by the Persian kings, look in Malachi chapter 3, verse 8. He said, "Will you rob God? Yet you are robbing me. But you say, have we robbed you?" He said, "In tithes and offerings." Yeah, but we're under Persia, and they take this heavy tax. "You're robbing me," he said. And so you see, this was the deal under the law. Now, in Matthew 23:23, the Pharisees tithed of even the smallest herbs. You see, and Jesus rebuked them. No, he didn't. He rebuked them for their hypocrisy, that they tithed these smallest things, but they were unmerciful and didn't take care of the weightier matters of the law. He said, "These things you should have done and not let the others undone." So he did not lift the tithe even under Roman taxation. So under the taxing of the Israelite kings, under the taxing of the Persian kings, under the taxing of the Roman kings, under the Old Testament, under the Old Law, unless I've missed something, and if I have, I'll be open to being corrected, that's what they did. Their failure, Malachi chapter 3, was robbing God. All right, what about under the New Testament? Tithing under the New Testament. Now, we have several principles. You're familiar with these verses, so I'll just be able to mention them in passing for sake of time. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 2, that they were told to lay by and store up on the first day of the week as he may prosper. There are, in the New Testament, if I've counted correctly, 9 passages that talk about tithing. 9. Not one of them is talking about what Christians are told to do or did under the New Testament covenant. So to say that tithing is a New Testament law is a mistake. There are churches today that tell their people that's God's plan for you today to tithe. There is no New Testament passage that teaches that. And don't leave this sermon today, this teaching session, thinking that's what I'm saying. I am not saying that. I want to make that very clear. Of the 9 passages, it has to do with people living under the law. But there are some guidelines. One is this one. As you may prosper. You may make more one week than the other. Make more one month than the other. That was a guideline that he set forth there in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 2. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9 verse 6, he encouraged them to give bountifully. We associate bountifully with amount. If you have a New American Standard Version, look in your footnote and you'll see it says give on the principle of blessings. On the principle of blessings. The Laodiceans gave bountifully, but they were a poor people. It's not so much amount as the idea of the desire to be a part of rendering a blessing. It's back to attitude again. And that's the principle that's involved in bountifully instead of a tight, straightened heart. It's the openness and generosity of wanting to share in whatever it is, in this case, the relief of fellow saints. In 2 Corinthians 9:7, a very interesting little phrase, and it says, as he has purposed in his heart. Here's a principle about giving. It's not a matter you get to the building and say, let me see what I've got in my pocket here. Oh, let me see what I've got left over at the end of the week. No, you purpose, you think about it, you plan, you decide. As husbands and wives, shouldn't you sit down and talk about this? Shouldn't you? Maybe the wife has income. The man has income. Maybe only one has income. But it's a matter of purpose. Well, how do you decide? That's what we're talking about today. How am I going to purpose? I want to do what God wants. I want to have a part in His work, but I want to be reasonable in this. I want to follow the guidelines. There's a matter of purposing involved as he's purposed in his heart. And then he said, with a cheerful heart. God loves a cheerful giver. We're not trying to coerce anybody to give. That wouldn't do you any good. That's not what God wants. The only way that cheerfulness will come is based on what we read in the first part of chapter 8, when these people first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. Then they wanted, the Macedonians begged for the privilege of having a share in the work of relieving fellow Christians. And so here you see the idea with a cheerful heart. Now there's one more I call your attention to. Turn back to Acts chapter 5. Acts chapter 5. While tithing is not a New Testament guideline or requirement, that's the way I should put it, requirement for how much we give, we need to be honest about what we're giving. Somebody said, well, I give all I can give. Quit lying. There's nobody gives all they can give. There was a man Jesus told to do that. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. He walked away. He didn't tell you to do that. Now here's Ananias and Sapphira. They had some land. You know the story. They had a piece of property, verse 1. They kept back some of the price for himself with his wife's knowledge. Here's the husband and wife, see, together, discussing this thing, planning this thing. And so whatever you do about your giving, remember the Lord knows what goes on in your bedroom or in your kitchen or at the table. Or you're riding down the road and talking about it, all right? So Ananias came and he presented this money, and Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart the lie of the Holy Spirit? He brought a portion of it, verse 2, and he says, you've lied. Well, what was the lie? Look at verse 7. There elapsed an interval of about 3 hours, and his wife came in not knowing what had happened. Peter responded to her, tell me whether you sold the land for such and such a price. Is this what you got for that piece of property? Oh, yeah, that's what we got for it. Liar. Did she have to give it all? No. How much did she have to give? I don't know. I know she had to give cheerfully. I know it should have proceeded out of an attitude of wanting to share in the work that was going on here in Jerusalem as the church was beginning. I know that. How much? There's no how much stated. But don't lie about it. Ananias died, she died. What a solemn rebuke. Don't lie about your giving. It's an honor system. What's 10%? How much are you giving? Are you giving all you should? Are you giving out of a heart of devotion and cheer, or just to kind of keep the wolves at bay so nobody says anything about you not giving? Now, I don't know, but God knows. It's an honor system. It was an honor system under the Old Testament. And by the way, let me say, you know, we've made all these points about the Old Testament, and somebody said, well, that was the Old Testament law. You know, this matter of the tithing and all of that kind of thing. Look, under the Old Testament, they were to give cheerfully. We've studied that in that sermon we preached 2 weeks ago. They gave with a cheerful heart. Under the Old Testament, it was to be out of devotion to God. Under the Old Testament, it was to be an honor system. That kind of thing. So don't contrast that with the new. That's not the contrast, folks. That we just have a good spirit and attitude of joy. No, that's what they should have done back then, too. And so that's not the contrast. There was a stated amount. That was a theocracy. That nation was God's nation. He promised to bless them. But here's what he said you can do. And that's what they did. All right, now, how about our offering? We've already read 2 Corinthians 9:7. He said, as you have purposed in your heart. Okay, the question, well, how much? Has anybody ever asked that? I was asked that recently. How much? You ever ask that to yourself? What if a fellow Christian comes to you? Can you help me? I'm trying to do what's right. How much should we give? Now, there is where the study of tithing might be valuable to us. Here's what you can tell them without stretching anything. You can tell them, look, tithing is what godly men of the past gave, even before the law. Here's what Abraham gave to Melchizedek. Here's what Jacob pledged to give to the Lord if God blessed him. That much I know. That's just stating a matter of fact. I know this, that it's what God required under the law. That's a fact, isn't it? That's not stretching anything. That's just the facts. Furthermore, I know that today, while that's what God stated under the law, I live under a greater covenant than that law. That was a great covenant and a great law. But the covenant under which I live is even greater. And while the cause under that law was great, the support of the Levitical priesthood, and very important for the nation, we serve even a higher purpose, and that is the gospel of Jesus Christ and the salvation of men's souls through it. We have a similar purpose. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. It's interesting when Paul was talking about his right of support for preaching the gospel, the analogies that he made. If you ever want to study about preacher support, this is an excellent chapter to go to. He refused the Corinthian support, although he argued for his right to receive it. And when you look at chapter 9, he said, verse 4, do we not have a right to eat and drink? He's not asking if we have a right to eat and drink, or do we have to go on a famine or a fast and diet? Right to eat and drink and be supported to eat and drink. That's the question of the context. Read it, you'll see. Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife? He's not asking if he has a right to marry. Do I have a right to have a wife and be supported in my work with this wife? Same thing down in verse 6. Do not only Barnabas and I have a right to refrain from work. A lot of jokes made about preachers not working. Here's the verse that said we don't have to work, see? No, it's a right to refrain from secular work to support yourself. I have a right. Paul made tents, but he said, I have a right to not have to do that, to expect to be supported in the gospel. So he used some common illustrations. He used a soldier in verse 7. What about soldiers? How are they able to devote themselves to their work? What about a man who has a vineyard? But then, after giving these secular illustrations, so I don't know what soldiers were paid in the Roman army, what provisions were made, but he says, look around you. Look at common examples every day. The point is, a laborer is worthy of his hire, as you'll see. That's the idea. And so he said now, verse 8, he said, am I speaking these things according to human judgment? I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? That is only. Or does not the law also say these things? And that appeals to the law. And so now look down at verse 14. So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. So also is what? Go back up and read verse 13. He's talking about the very things we've been reading about in the book of Numbers chapter 18. And he says, so also the Lord directed, like that. So, can I go back and read Numbers 18 and God's plan and draw any kind of conclusions from that about the giving or contributing for the work of the Lord today? I think we can. It has a similar purpose, support of those men who ought to be dedicated in their time and effort to the work of the Lord. Furthermore, we're richly blessed. The Jewish nation was richly blessed. We're richly blessed. We are rich people, folks, all over this world. You compare us to other nations. Somebody told me the other day, I don't know what it was based on, that the United States right now is the richest country that's ever been in the history of the world. I don't know if that's so or not. We are rich people. We're richly blessed. And then, now you're back to comparison. All right? How does your giving compare? In view of all of these facts, what faithful men did, godly men, what God required under the law, your prosperity, the covenant under which we live, how does your giving compare with all of that? Giving reflects our attitude toward God's people. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 8. 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 4. It said, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. They had never met these saints. They lived hundreds and hundreds of miles away. They were of a different culture than they were. They were Jewish saints. The people giving were Gentile saints. But they were Christians. They shared the same gospel. And it's because of that and their attitude towards them. Down in verse 24, he said, show them the proof of your love for these people because they're God's people. Look down in chapter 9 and verse 13. Because of the proof given by this ministry, they glorify God for your obedience to the confession of the gospel of Christ and for the liberality of your contribution. Not how much you gave, for the singleness of heart manifested in your desire to have fellowship with them. That's what those words mean. They glorify God that Jews and Gentiles who normally had nothing to do with Jews would want to dig into their pockets and contribute to these Jews who were in need for one reason. They're Christians. And so this giving would reflect this attitude. That's really what Paul was concerned about in this whole thing, is this underlying idea. Then over in Philippians chapter 4, look in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 10. Now here's Paul in prison. He writes to this group of people in Philippi. He said, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last you've revived your concern for me. Concern? What do you mean their concern? He said, now, indeed, you were concerned, but you lacked opportunity. Well, what is he talking about? Their attitude toward him and his work in preaching the gospel. Here he is in prison, and he's very limited. But he says, you're concerned about me and my work. That's what's behind their contribution. And it's a reflection of their attitude toward Paul and his work in the gospel. Read the rest of the text down through about verse 18. You'll see that's the idea. Over in 3 John verse 5 and 6, look at this. In 3 John verse 5, "Beloved, you're acting faithful in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they're strangers, for they have testified to your love before the church. You do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God, for." For what? Look. "They went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles." We're not going to be supported by the Gentiles. We're going to depend on God's people, or whatever else they can do, I guess, to support themselves. And you're to be commended because they have dedicated themselves to that. You see, it's an attitude toward these dedicated servants who are going about teaching the Word of God. So, giving reflects our attitude towards God's people, whether those in need or whether those who are devoted themselves to the preaching of the gospel. It's a manifesting attitude toward God's work. In the Philippian letter, he said, "I thank God my prayer for your participation in the gospel from the first day until now." And in chapter 4:15, he mentions the fact that that's what it has to do with the preaching of the gospel. And we've just read this here in verses 6 and verse 8. Look at verse 8. "We ought to support such men." Why? "That we might be fellow workers with the truth." With the truth. It's not the men so much as it is, it's God's work. They're teaching God's truth. These men we support, for example, maybe they don't write back and say, "I baptized three people." But they're taking God's people, they're educating them, they're building, they're strengthening, they're trying to equip them. That's what you have a share in. God's work. That's what it's all about. And then, ultimately, it's your reflection of your attitude toward God. Here in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and in verse 5, "They first gave themselves to the Lord and to us." In 3 John verse 7, where we just read, note this little statement that's made there by John. He said, "They went out for the sake of the name." For the sake of the name. What's that? For the sake of God. And you're to be commended because of your interest in that. And the same thing in Philippians 4:18. When he talked about their contribution, he said it's a sacrifice well-pleasing to God. Well-pleasing to God. So you see again the emphasis on our attitude toward God. You know, when our taxes increase, when our bills mount, when we go on vacation, why is it that the first thing to be reduced or to quit or to skip is our contributions? What does that reflect about our attitude toward God's people? They still, if it's the needy saints, we don't have that so much today, but those who are doing God's work, that's still there. God's work needs to go on. What about God? Do we go on vacation from God? Do we let these things keep us from our sense of devotion, our love for God and for His work? There's people that, you know, leave town, go on vacation, they never make up what they had purpose to give. Imagine that under the Jewish system. Anyway, it's a reflection of our attitude. You think about that. Let's end with 2 Corinthians chapter 8. This very concept was in one of the songs we sang today, "Lead Me to Calvary, Think About the Lord," and how that would change our focus in life. Here Paul in two chapters is talking about giving, about contribution, about offerings that they would make for needy Christians. What does he turn their attention to? 2 Corinthians 8:9. "You know the grace." Grace is attitude, favor. "You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." What does that have to do with giving? Why did he put that in there? When the Father talks about giving and what he wants for his people to do, I'll tell you what, you're dealing with a God that gave way far beyond anything he's ever asked us to give. He gave his Son. His Son gave up the glories of heaven to die for you and me. In chapter 9 and verse 15, in this same setting of these two chapters, he concluded it with this statement of praise, thanks to God for His indescribable gift. What do you think He's talking about? The money? No. Thanks be to God for His indescribable gift.